From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the latest as Detroit creditors continue to take aims at the treasures at the DIA.
It would spell the end of the DIA as a viable institution.
Plus, the state Senate could be close to a vote on expanding the controversial Education Achievement Authority.
It's just going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Most of the votes that have taken place have been very, very close.
And how growing up in poverty and pollution threatens the health of Michigan children. We talk with Michigan Radio's Lester Graham.
They're not aware of it. I mean, it's like, you know, you hear old people say, we were poor, but we didn't know we were poor. I mean, it's the same kind of situation. This is their normal.
We have those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Now that it appears Detroit pensioners will not have to take a big hit to their monthly pension checks because of the bankruptcy, should Detroit's other creditors expect a better deal than Kevin Orr first offered? I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we explore just how these questions could affect the fate of the treasures at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And then we talk with Michigan Radio's Lester Graham about the challenges faced by Michigan children who are growing up in poverty and pollution. But first, State Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville hopes there will be a final vote this week on a bill to expand the state's controversial Education Achievement Authority. That's a state-run authority meant to turn around some of Michigan's lowest-performing schools. Right now, the EAA runs 15 schools in Detroit. This legislation would pave the way for it to expand up to 50 schools statewide. Here to talk more about this is Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing reporter, Jake Neer. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Cindy.
So there still is a lot of opposition to this legislation in Lansing, isn't there?
Well, anytime you're talking about the state coming in and taking over local school districts, of course, you're going to get a lot of pushback. If you ask any Democrat almost in the legislature, save for one or two, you know, they'll tell you this is a failed experiment, that the EAA has done a poor job, that students are leaving in droves, and that, you know, they're not financially viable. There's questions about student safety. And then there are also some Republicans who are concerned about, you know, the state, again, coming into their local school district and taking over the schools that, you know, that their constituents' kids go to. But, of course, there's a lot of support. This is the governor's probably number one education priority right now in the legislature. And so there's plenty of Republicans who are on board with this. It's just going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Most of the votes that have taken place have been very, very close.
You know, in fact, Senate Democrats, I know, held their own hearing. It was an unofficial hearing, but they had testimony from teachers and parents and students, and that painted a very, very critical picture of the EAA in schools. Like you said, education run amok. How are EAA officials responding to all of this?
Well, you know, they say that there have been accusations of students being actually hit, physically struck by teachers from former teachers. That was one of the teachers that testified yesterday at that hearing you mentioned. And they say they haven't had any reports of that, and they're not aware of any abuse or physical problems in their schools. And they say that students are doing better. I mean, most of those who have looked at the MEEP scores, the standardized test scores, say that they're mixed. But the EAA, the officials there say, well, if you look at it in a certain way, you can see students improving that weren't improving when these schools were part of the Detroit public schools. So it depends on who you ask, I guess, with these numbers. But, you know, they say the students are doing better and we should expand it.
And what does Senator Richardville say about all this criticism?
Well, he says that, you know, it's not a perfect solution. He says the EAA may have its problems, but at the same time, we can't just not do anything. We have to come in and figure something out so that these students aren't just stuck in failing schools. Here's another piece that he had to say to reporters yesterday after that unofficial hearing from Democrats.
It's not like we're going to do this and then walk away for the next 10 years and say, I hope this works. I mean, the people in the education community and the people in the education committee are on those committees because they have a passion for educating children and realize the importance of it. They're not just going to turn their heads if we do something. I think they would be very involved in making sure that there were positive results. And if not, make changes.
So, of course, he says that, you know, the state is going to have to take an active role in making sure that, you know, that this is not education run amok if they do expand it.
And now we've got House Bill 4369. It's been passed by the House, and it's been tweaked a few times. What if the Senate can't agree to the language in 4369, House Bill?
Well, we just had a kind of an impromptu session with Richardville's spokesperson, Amber McCann, after today's session. And she said that if, you know, they really want a vote on Thursday on this bill, but they don't want to make changes to it because that would send it back to the House for a third House vote on this. And they don't see there's any appetite in the House to take this up again. So if they can't agree on the language that the House sent over recently on this bill, then Amber McCann says that maybe it's time to just start from scratch again and start a completely new bill.
How popular, Jake, is this bill among the GOP caucus?
Well, again, Amber McCann, Senator Richardville's spokesperson, said that among caucus members, this is more popular than expanding Medicaid under Obamacare, but it's less popular than right to work. So I don't know how much of a sense that gives you, but both of those did pass. So, you know, keep that in mind.
There we go. Jake Neer, Lansing reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, thanks, Jake.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
How are business owners in Michigan feeling about the economy? It's an important question. Those business owners are doing the hiring or not. The 2014 Chase Business Leaders Outlook has just been released, containing the views of some 3,500 leaders of small and mid-sized businesses across the nation. Here to give us the views of these business leaders is Jim Glassman, senior economist with J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Good to have you with us, Jim.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's take the macro view first, the national level. How optimistic or how gloomy did you find that small and mid-sized business leaders are overall?
You know, we find that our business leaders in our survey are quite optimistic about the national economy. They're even more optimistic about their own company's performance. I think this is interesting because, you know, we know that the small business community, it's been very difficult for them with the economy going into the recession and coming back slowly. The fact that this community is becoming more optimistic, and by the way, this year's response is they are more optimistic this year than they were last year, it just confirms that the tide is rising, and it's even touching folks who tend to see it later.
Yeah, looking at your data from like close to the ground here in Michigan, I see 32% of business owners are optimistic about the global economy. But then you get to the national, it goes to 58% and 68% about the local economy. I'm just wondering why you think it is so much lower for the global economic prospects.
You know, that's an interesting question. And this is what I find most intriguing about our survey. The things that business leaders know the most about their own business, they are most optimistic. When you ask them about what about the state economy, what about the national economy, what about the global, it gets less optimistic. And I think probably what's going on is your views about the global economy, not surprisingly, are shaped by what you hear on the airwaves. So what's been the news over the last couple of years about the global economy has been the crisis in Europe. Mm-hmm. Is Greece going to blow up? Now the Russians and the Ukraine crisis. I think the problem is, views about the global economy probably are influenced a lot by things that we hear rather than things that we actually know are going on.
And what are respondents worrying about? What do they feel threatens their business growth?
The principal uncertainty has always been, is my business going to be growing or not? Is the tide coming in or not? That's always the dominant concern. What they tell us, though, is they're still very challenged by regulations and by the healthcare landscape. But actually, interestingly, this year, our survey showed that they're becoming less concerned about that. Maybe it's because they've gotten a reprieve and the employer mandate's been pushed out a couple of years. Maybe it's because they understand the landscape better, they understand the rules better, and so they're working around that. But I think fundamentally, if they are optimistic about their own business, a lot of these other issues are going to be receding as a concern.
And what did you hear about hiring plans?
What the larger companies told us is that they're adding workers, they're planning to add workers. It's not too different a response than we saw a year ago. So the trends seem kind of steady in terms of adding employment. And by the way, that's consistent with some of the national numbers that we see from ADP, for example, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But what's also interesting to me is the larger companies in our survey say that they are planning to reduce the amount of part-time employment. Part-time employment has been a way for companies to adjust to the challenging environment. So an awful lot of Americans are working part-time jobs because they can't find a full-time job because work at their companies is slow. And so this is really telling, because if companies, as they gain confidence, are willing to start extending those part-time jobs into full-time jobs, then that's a hidden source of improvement for the job market. And I think it's, you know, if this message that's coming from this survey is right, there's a lot more to the job market coming than just new jobs. It means that the character of the jobs, the quality of the jobs is also improving. And I think that's very promising.
So bottom line, do you hear from business leaders, have we shaken off the Great Recession, or is it still a work in progress?
No, I think that's true. I think it's largely history. From a lot of different perspectives, it seems as though the excesses from the Great Recession, the crisis, are largely been addressed. And, you know, one way you see this, by the way, is if you compare the performance of the U.S. economy with all the other developed economies, the U.S. is powering out of this downturn much better than the Europeans, the Japanese. And I think increasingly people are feeling, to different degrees, that the problems are largely behind us. And that's why everybody is expecting to see a better performance this year, next year, and they're expecting to see slightly faster growth. Most of us economists are forecasting that, as is the Fed.
We've been talking about the 2014 Chase Business Leaders Outlook as we speak with Jim Glassman, senior economist with J.P. Morgan, Chase & Company. Jim, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Children growing up in poverty face huge challenges. One challenge that might not be top of mind, though, is that of pollution. As part of Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project, reporter Lester Graham has spent the past 4 months exploring this. Tomorrow at this time, you can hear the results, his documentary, Growing Up in Poverty and Pollution. Lester joins us now. And when we talk about kids living in poverty, just how many kids in Michigan are indeed in poverty?
Well, we're talking about 500,000 kids. It's about 25% of the state's entire kid population, people under 17 or 17 and under. That's a lot of kids we've got to worry about. Now, there's a difference, though, between talking about poverty and extreme poverty. And the documentary spends a lot of time talking about extreme poverty, which is a little less clearly defined, but you know it when you see it.
And the idea that we have hundreds of thousands of kids growing up in Michigan in poverty and in pollution, that is stunning. And what you do is you focus on some of the biggest health threats they face: asthma, lead poisoning, and then violence and the constant stress of living in poverty. So let's start by talking about asthma.
Well, we're not sure why, but there's a larger prevalence of asthma in African-American kids. And in the Detroit area, there are twice as many kids with asthma. I don't mean in sheer numbers. I mean in proportion. Mm-hmm. Twice as many kids are – 20% of all kids in Detroit have asthma. Now, you could see some of the reasons. Clearly, it's pollution, smokestack pollution, highway pollution, things like that, which are real triggers for asthma. But the other thing that we're finding is that older homes – are real triggers for asthma too, because there are leaks that cause mold and mildew. There are all kinds of dust. There is a real problem with pests, because if you have cockroaches or rodents, the feces or the body parts from those animals and those insects are a real bad asthma trigger. And when you are in an apartment or something like that, if one unit gets cockroaches, the whole building gets cockroaches. And so a kid can't really escape that.
And it really is – it needs to be understood what a serious disease this is and that it does kill.
Yeah, in a two-year period, 393 people in Michigan died of asthma. I was astonished by that. I just didn't expect that. And it's rare – I mean, it's not every day and every kid isn't going to die. It can be controlled. That's the other problem with this, though. If you can't get to the pharmacy, or if you can't get to the doctor, or if you don't really understand the disease, mm-hmm. you put your kid at much greater risk. And that is a real problem that they're working on as well. The other part of that is, you know, we don't have the outreach in every county to help these kids with asthma. Some counties have good programs. Some hospitals or health systems have follow-up visits to teach them how to use their inhalers, to take a look at the house and see what allergens are there, what asthma triggers are there. But not every county has that.
lead poisoning, your section of your documentary, Growing Up in Poverty and Pollution, that focuses on lead poisoning, really, really grabbed me. You met a mom named Jessica Jeffries who you really bring the story of what it's like to have a child with lead poisoning home.
Yeah, when she found out, I mean, it was a real, real surprise to her.
I was really scared, especially when they told me what can happen. You know, she could have been brain damaged. She could have died, anything. Even now, she has to be monitored because these signs can come up later in her life.
In this case, the CDC's threshold for lead in the blood is 5 micrograms per deciliter. This child had 55 micrograms per deciliter, 11 times the threshold. And there are kids with even greater amounts. And that's really, really scary because nobody saw anything wrong until they took the blood test.
And then you think of the long-range health and behavior effects that you discovered.
That's the one thing. They suggest, there are studies that suggest we used to have leaded gasoline. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest source of lead contamination in blood. And they suggest that the last couple of decades where we've seen crime rates go down, it is because we no longer have lead in gasoline. Fewer people are contaminated by lead, and that means fewer behavioral problems, fewer systems like that. So what happens is when the lead gets into you, it can cause IQ deficiency. It can cause behavioral problems. It can, in fact, they found in one study, they tested the inmates at a prison in Pennsylvania, and they found that the ones who were in for the most violent crime had the highest levels of lead in their bones from when they were exposed as kids. I mean, this is not just, oh, that's too bad. This is a societal problem, and we're doing almost nothing about it.
And you look at violence and the everyday stresses of living in poverty, and I was stunned by what you discovered, the effects this has on a child's brain.
Right. There's a study that indicated that they can actually do an MRI of an adult who lived in poverty, extreme poverty, and in a violent area, a high crime area. And because you're constantly keyed up, because you're constantly stressed, you basically are using that part of your brain that's reserved for that fight or flight
mm-hmm.
syndrome.
Yep.
But it's on all the time. And it actually leaves a scar because you've overused it, you've abused it, or it's been abused because you've used it so much. And you can see it in an MRI.
Wow.
The other thing about living in a high crime area and all that stress you're undergoing is it aggravates these other illnesses. Now, if you've got asthma, you're more likely to have problems with asthma attacks if you live in a high crime area where you're stressed all the time. And you can imagine if you've got behavioral problems because of lead in your blood, this is going to be a problem too, because how are you going to react now when you feel stressed or you feel threatened in any way? It really, really opens up some big, big, big societal questions that I think that should not be ignored, but for the most part are being ignored.
So, Lester, as you looked at all of these issues, asthma and lead poisoning and the stress of living in poverty and violence, what does it take, do you think, to convince the policymakers who hold the purse strings and the general public that these are really problems that affect all of Michigan?
Well, if you ask the legislature and the governor, they will say, well, we increased funding for that last year, and it's in the budget again this year for both asthma and for lead, especially for lead. Mm-hmm. But even at the current levels, even at these increased levels, of those tens of thousands of houses that need to be fixed, that need lead abatement, we're getting to 160 houses a year in the whole state, 160 houses. That's the best we could do?
Most surprised you or touched you as you reported this story?
The kids, of course, the kids. I mean, I talked to kids who live in a high crime area, and they're not aware of it. I mean, it's like, you know, you hear old people say, we were poor, but we didn't know we were poor. I mean, it's the same kind of situation. This is their normal. The problem is, they're running around stressed and looking over their shoulder all the time, and that's normal for them, but that is not normal. It's not the way we are supposed to be using our brains at that young age. And again, that leads to problems later in life.
Growing Up in Poverty and Pollution, a State of Opportunity documentary, airs tomorrow at 3 p.m. and again at 10 p.m. Lester Graham, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cynthia.
This Saturday, hundreds of people with video cameras and smartphones in hand will descend upon Detroit. Their mission, to document stories that most affect the future of the city. It's called One Day in Detroit, Your Day, Your City, Your Future. Detroit is one of 11 cities across America to be a part of this one-day event. We're joined now by Stephen McGee, who's the local producer of One Day in Detroit. Hello.
How's it going?
How was it that Detroit was chosen as one of the 11 cities for this big event on Saturday?
Well, as you know, Detroit, there's a lot of things happening here. You know, the challenges in Detroit have been so well documented that nationwide, people are still, you know, becoming more and more interested about our city. And so when the producers from New York and L.A. were looking at kind of what are the cities that define America right now, Detroit had to be one of them from their perspective. So Detroit became that when they visited last year and they got toured around. And, you know, the first day they were here, they're like, what is this city about? The second day they were like, yeah, I kind of get it. And the third day they were like, I want to move here.
So tell us, how do you describe what's going to happen Saturday in Detroit?
Well, the momentum right now is incredible, so I'm pretty excited to see what happens exactly on Saturday. We have currently about 350 people signed up on our Facebook page to be documenting the city. So not only is it filmmakers who live in Detroit and live in the surrounding areas, but it's also just concerned citizens who know of positive stories or stories that should get out to people outside of their circle of influence. And so it's going to be people from all backgrounds with all types of cameras, from cell phones to, you know, really expensive cameras, from people who have a little bit experience on stories to people who are, you know, Emmy Award winning filmmakers. And so on Saturday, people are going to be filming what they want. Some filmmakers are going to be addressing certain topics like housing and immigration, and other people are going to kind of be doing a little bit more broad range.
Well, it's interesting, actually, on the website that you've put together on onedayindetroit.org, there are 10 questions for the future of your city. So are these meant to kind of prompt the filmmakers' thoughts into what questions you're going to explore?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's a lot of stories within 140 square miles, and Detroit is ripe with people who are making a difference. That said, when you try and make a story arc across 11 cities, you definitely need some type of structure to be able to create a three-part film series, three-part television series. And so these 10 questions kind of help people who want direction be able to approach what they know about the city in a way that can, you know, kind of standardize the response. But however, because this is an open platform and people can do whatever they want, people can either address those questions like, why are you here in your city? What do you see, you know, where do you see hope in the city? But then also questions like, what are the challenges and who are the people that aren't being, you know, serviced by the city? And so basically, you know, people are going to be addressing those questions and sometimes they're not. So I think that's going to be, you know, because this is an open platform, it's pretty exciting.
And is there any sense of what kind of desired length these videos will be, or is it really up to the creator?
A couple of filmmakers are going to be doing, you know, even up to 5 stories in one day, spending about 2 to 3 hours in each location to be so that we get as broad of perspective of Detroit as possible. Some people will only be uploading, you know, a clip of 10 seconds to 1 minute answering the question or showing what they want. The executive producer really gave a great example of one day in New York a couple of years ago where a pregnant mother was at LaGuardia Airport in New York City, and she's just doing a selfie, you know, piece to the camera, basically, where she's like, hi, I'm like, this is my name, and this is my baby. My husband hasn't come home from Iraq yet, but he's about to, and he's never met this baby. And so she shows him, turns the camera around, he's walking up and shows the embrace and the baby meeting the husband for the first time. Mm. A minute out of this lady's life that, you know, speaks about so much and yet doesn't really answer any of the questions, but in turn actually does. And so it's kind of, you know, I feel like there's going to be a broad range of responses like that. And, you know, the entry level is from turn the camera on and go. So, you know, I'm pretty excited to see what comes back.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Stephen McGee. He's the local producer of One Day in Detroit, Your Day, Your City, Your Future. This Saturday, 24 hours, turning people loose with whatever camera they can get their hands on, including your smartphone camera, and telling the stories that really capture what most affects the future of the city of Detroit. What will be done then with the footage, Stephen? Once everybody's done and that 24-hour period is done, then what?
Well, I think what's really exciting here is the opportunity to inform the national audience about what's going on in Detroit. Because our challenges are so well documented, people do associate our city with blight and with crime and with the challenges. But with this content, we have an ability to inform that understanding with basically the human element. And so not only will there be a geotagged map, which for people who don't necessarily understand geotagged, when you upload your footage, you'll kind of tell the intersection of where you shot it, and that'll be placed on a map where the story will be shown in that area. And so from that content, we're going to hold a film festival in August, and then from that content, we're going to be also editing that into the story of 11 other cities and having a three-part series on a national public spotlight, on national public television. And I think that's going to be pretty exciting because people from Los Angeles and New York and Atlanta, southern part of Texas, they're all going to be looking at what's going on here. So, you know, this is a huge opportunity for us to kind of put our next step forward.
Stephen, what do you hope the participants bring to this project, to this one-day project?
Well, with any story, it's all about being authentic and finding the voice who's telling that story. And so I'm really hoping that people who do hear this pretty amazing event will be able to turn on their camera and find the story that they want to tell and see that the heart behind this project is really one where we're trying to broaden the perspective of Detroit because we're Detroiters. And it's because it's our own story. And for the past 3 months, I've been looking at people's stories, you know, from the east side to the west side, looking at the block-by-block approaches where government has come in and helped, and sometimes, a lot of times, where there has been no help and people have stepped up. And when I see those types of stories, it makes me understand why I'm here. It helps me understand that this city is not just a city that has nowhere to go but up, but is actually up and going forward. That said, there's a lot of people who still, you know, are in the challenges that we know about. So my hope is that more people will get to understand kind of what's going on here through this participation, and that people can own this project as their own and really take advantage of this national platform.
And it's important for everyone listening to us, having our conversation, to understand that it's not too late to get involved. You can go to onedayindetroit.org and get all the information. And then you've got a period of time after you shoot on Saturday, right, to upload your video?
Yeah, you know, some people were really excited about shooting a minute here, you know, in Southwest, shooting a minute here in the Northeast, and uploading it immediately that day. And then some people are going to be addressing larger topics and editing the piece together. Both of those types of projects are really important for this project to gain as wide of a geotag map as possible. And so if you can't upload on Saturday, you can have up to 30 days to be able to, which I think is May 26th, to be able to upload that footage.
You can get all the information you need on One Day in Detroit, your day, your city, your future. Just go to the website, onedayindetroit.org. And we have been talking to the local producer of One Day in Detroit, Stephen McGee. Thanks for talking with us, and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Detroit's bankruptcy battle continues to unfold, a question continues to remain. What will happen to the city-owned pieces at the Detroit Institute of Arts? The city recently reached a tentative agreement with retirees and pensioners. Might that impact the possible sale of DIA work to satisfy Detroit's bondholders and other creditors? Mark Stryker explored that question recently in the Detroit Free Press. Good to have you back on Stateside, Mark.
It's nice to be here. Thanks.
So, Kevin Org gets the crucial endorsement of the pension officials representing the general city retirees and the police and fire retirees. So just how important is that in keeping these city-owned DIA pieces out of the hands of creditors?
Well, it could be crucial because it gives Orr considerably more leverage to help get his plan of adjustment through and approved by the judge in the bankruptcy case. And his plan doesn't include selling any art, even though other creditors will object. But having the endorsement of the pensioners of his plan, which includes this grand bargain we have talked about mm-hmm. many times, where foundations and the state would put up basically $815-16 million, and the DIA would be a part of that, and that money would go to pensioners in exchange for taking the art off the table and spinning off the DIA from city control. The pensioners have essentially endorsed that plan now, and so that means the creditors who are still going after the arts still have legal arguments, but experts we talked to said that may well make it easier for Rhodes to confirm the plan.
Well, when you think about the legal arguments versus, let's call it, the optics, and when you think of the countless interviews with desperate pensioners, and there's certainly no shortage of that, people who risked having such huge impacts to their pension checks versus Syncora. So the optics of that have to be looked at differently than the actual legality.
Absolutely. We have to remember that judges, of course, are humans. One thing about the grand bargain and as part of the plan of adjustment is it does make it easier for Judge Rhodes to come up with a politically palatable solution. But the fact is you have to account for the value of the city-owned art. It's a city asset.
Mm-hmm.
And so somehow you have to account for the fact that there are millions, billions of dollars worth of art at the museum. And the grand bargain does that. It says we have $815 million and we'll put that on the table on behalf of the art. And it gives the judge a way of allowing his plan, the plan to be confirmed while still accounting for the art and also saving the museum and giving more money to pensioners. Legally, however, the arguments still remain out there. And the question is, does the plan that Orr has put forward treat creditors unfairly? And, you know, there's a central argument in bankruptcy, which is that you cannot treat creditors within the same class of creditors that are similar. You can't treat them differently. And so the question will become, does the plan that Orr has suggested that favors pensioners against the bond insurers like Syncora mm-hmm. and others, mm-hmm. does that in effect treat them unfairly? Now, the city will argue that these are different kinds of creditors and that treating creditors unfairly is not about treating everybody equal. It's making sure that if you do treat them unequally, that there is a fair and rational basis for doing so. And there is a strong argument to be made that pensioners should be treated more favorably than other bond insurers and other creditors because pensioners have worked all their lives
yes.
for the cities, because in fact, the state constitution has protections against cutting pensions, and that these people don't have the means to recover the money. They need the money more than wealthy bond insurers from Wall Street. And those are all very strong rational arguments mm-hmm. for treating these creditors differently.
Fascinating legal stuff. I'm talking with Detroit Free Press writer Mark Stryker as we kind of explore what the impact of the endorsement of pension officials to the plan of adjustment that Kevin Orr put out there. What does that mean for preserving the DIA's collection? So I'm wondering, we know talks with the bondholders are continuing. We also know just based on what the pensioners and retirees got, we heard draconian cuts were offered at the beginning. And then here you have police and fire taking no cut in their monthly pension checks, and a much more modest cut for the other retirees. So could the situation evolve and change for Syncora or Financial Guarantee Insurance or these other creditors?
It's certainly possible. These are negotiations, and, you know, classic negotiation strategy is you start with your worst offer so there's room to grow and it, you know, gets better and better and begins to look better and better. And so it's possible that Orr could come up with more money for the bond insurers, but I'm not exactly sure where it's going to come from, and that's you know, that's the question. The extraordinary thing about the grand bargain is that we have $816 million have been flooded into the bankruptcy to give Orr extra cash to begin to dole that out. Now, what they've decided to do is basically that money was dedicated specifically, came from the foundation specifically for pensioners. And so the bond insurers and the bondholders are not getting any of that. So, you know, could, let's say, if Orr gets a fantastic water and sewer deal that, you know, creates a bigger pool of cash mm-hmm. than he otherwise thought he was going to get. Yes, maybe more money could be thrown at the creditors and they would that would appease them some and they would call off the dogs as regards to the art. But yeah. I'm skeptical, and I'm also skeptical given what the bond insurers have done so far in court. They've made every indication that they are going to go after the art as long as they can until the judge says, I'm sorry, it's off the table.
And what do legal minds tell you? How much chance do these experts think there really exists that the likes of Cincora and Financial Guarantee Insurance could force the city to sell its art?
The people I've talked to said it's looking less and less likely that the bond insurers and the other creditors who seem so predatory toward the art will get their way and get the art put on the table. The legal arguments, the legal hurdles are stiff. Mm-hmm. The political hurdles are stiff. And the differences between a typical Chapter 11 corporate bankruptcy and a Chapter 9 bankruptcy are significant. And that is that the judge in a Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy has to think about the future viability of the city when he's making his decision. And this comes back to a question we've talked about before, which is, well, what is the value and role of an art museum like the DIA mm-hmm. in a city like Detroit? Well, it's part of the cultural soul, the cultural identity. It's a tourist attraction. It is part of the fabric of the city that makes a place livable, viable, a locus of creativity, mm-hmm. all the kinds of things that Detroit will need to survive as it goes forward
sure.
after post-bankruptcy. So the judge is able to consider all of that when he makes his decision, and those are all issues that could lead the judge to, again, put a shield around the art, particularly because he has accounted for the art in the $816 million coming from the grand bargain.
As much as Cincora and the others are saying that's a terrible lowball.
of course. And in fact, they are right, because there's no question that the value of the art at the museum is in the billions of dollars. No question. Let's remember that the Christie's estimate that we mm-hmm. was that the city commission some months ago came up with a value of $800 million or so just for 5% of the collection, the works that were bought directly with city funds.
Yes.
But the city technically owns every single piece of art in the museum, mm-hmm. and experts have told us that it's clearly billions of dollars worth of art. So these bond insurers are absolutely correct when they say that you're lowballing the value of the art. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a one-to-one value, and the judge can decide that, yes, $815 is a reasonable accounting for the value of the art in the context of this complete plan of adjustment, and considering that we need to leave the city in a place where it can survive and thrive post-bankruptcy.
And so what kind of timetable are we looking at, do you think, for this DIA question?
Well, there are two big things. One is, starting in May, the individual pensioners will vote on whether or not to accept the deal or not. As of now, the pension boards and the leadership negotiating teams mm-hmm. have accepted the deal and will recommend to their members that they vote yes, but we still got to get a yes vote mm-hmm. from the members themselves. So that's one thing. And then in July, we're going to see the mother of all bankruptcy trials when all of these questions get hashed out in court.
Well, it's always fascinating talking about this ever-changing story with you, Detroit Free Press writer Mark Stryker. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
The reality of creditors eyeing the works of the DIA has the museum world watching very, very closely. And in another story, recently the Delaware Art Museum announced it had decided, quote, with heavy hearts but clear minds, to sell up to 4 works from its collection to repay debt from an expansion. Ray Silverman's the director of the University of Michigan's Museum Studies Program. Can you compare, Ray, the Delaware Museum's decision to sell art with what's happening at the DIA? Of course, we know Detroit's is a municipal bankruptcy, but overall, that has to be a gut-wrenching decision to make.
Yeah, it is a gut-wrenching decision, and there are a couple differences. One is the scale of the decision. We're talking about a few works of art in terms of the Delaware Museum. We're talking about hundreds of works of art with regards to Detroit. And it's also a decision that is coming from a different place. In terms of Delaware, it was their board of trustees who made that decision. In the case of Detroit, it's going to be a decision that comes from a bankruptcy judge.
So it was an internal thing in Delaware versus a crammed down externally ordered decision, if indeed that comes in the DIA. Mm-hmm. I think it would be helpful for all of us to understand protocol or rules, if you will. And we should understand that museums do frequently sell works of art, but it's only to update their collections.
Yes. There are some very stringent guidelines that museums live by. There are ethical standards that have been in existence for many years now that basically stipulate that the only way that a museum can deaccession objects is if the funds or proceeds that are derived from such sales are used to purchase new material for the collection, or, stretching things a little bit, used for programming that supports the collection.
Okay.
In terms of conservation, for instance, could be used for hiring personnel that take care of the collection.
And as you say, that's even stretching it a little bit.
That's stretching it, yes.
So the idea of capital improvements or paying off debts, I can just see your face.
It's totally verboten.
And I noticed the director of the Delaware Museum, his quote was, "We're basically shunned for a period of years." What kind of consequences could a museum face for selling art to repay debt? And I assume Detroit would, even if it was an ordered decision from
myself. Yes, definitely. Yeah, in fact, I've been quoted in the Detroit press saying as much, that basically it would spell the end of the DIA as a viable institution, because there are lots of repercussions. Immediately there is censorship by a couple of very important bodies that oversee the museum world. There, with regards to art museums specifically, there's the Association of Art Museum Directors. And so there's a direct censorship that comes from that. And in the case of the Delaware Museum, they still are, I don't think it's come into effect yet, but an accredited American Alliance of Museums.
But
they will lose their accreditation. Mm-hmm. And so the implications are, one, they are no longer viable in terms of receiving certain kinds of funding from philanthropic foundations, from the government. They will be shunned in terms of probably not being able to get loans from other institutions. They will find it very difficult, basically, to participate as viable members of the profession. And perhaps most significantly, they're going to have difficulty getting philanthropic donors to give them art in the future.
Or money.
One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that for most art museums, the vast majority of objects in the collection are, in fact, donations. The DIA, I think 80-90% of the collection. Most people are giving those objects to a museum based on the assumption that those objects are going to be protected for posterity. And if they have any sense that these objects could possibly be sold to pay off debts of any sort in the future, all of a sudden those people are not going to be interested in giving to the museum anymore.
Well, how do you think, Ray, it would set new precedents, or would it, for the way museums do their business?
Well, it would be precedent setting as if museums, as cultural institutions, as not-for-profit cultural institutions, are finding it a big enough challenge these days to sort of make ends meet. I mean, this is the reason why Delaware had to sell those four works of art. And so many of these institutions are, living day to day.
Hand to mouth.
Yep, trying to make ends meet. And in many cases, I think it would make it impossible for some of these institutions to survive, because all of a sudden those few sources of support that exist would disappear. So,
when you look at how this has played out ever since the bankruptcy journey began in earnest, what course of action do you believe that the DIA can, should take in the face of all of this? Is there much that can be done really to protect itself when you know that it's really up to a bankruptcy judge?
Well, in the immediate case, things are kind of out of their hands. I mean, this solution that was arrived at that involved this consortium of foundations, the state of Michigan.
The grand bargain? Yes.
The grand bargain, yes. Yeah. Seemed to be a viable solution. And everyone was very excited about that, still is very excited about that. It was a wonderful sort of, what do you call it, circling of the wagons that went on. And the question is that going to be enough? Is this $800 million that is going to be given to the city to, you know, pay off some of that debt going to be adequate enough? And, you know, one of the scary things is, you know, a week or two ago, there were a number of investment firms that came on the scene.
With much fatter offers.
Much fatter offers, yeah, and just circling like vultures, you know, ready to pounce. And what they're looking at this material as purely as commodity, as something that can be purchased and then sold at a profit.
Ray Silverman's the director of the University of Michigan's Museum Studies Program. Thank you so much for talking with us, Ray.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And once again, a reminder that you should not miss Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity documentary tomorrow from reporter Lester Graham, Growing Up in Poverty and Pollution. That will be at this time tomorrow here on Michigan Radio. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Omar Sude, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let us talk Monday at 3 o'clock.